This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to play a book buzz for from Devon Miller, and because it is Black History Month, and it is one of my favorite book buzzes that he has done to promote authors. And it is so important that during Black History Month, we think, my goodness, we have so many things here to think about and to make better in this world. And one of the things I love about doing the book buzzes, we here at Joy on Paper, we now have a group, a family of wonderful, wonderful writers who are doing these book buzzes to promote authors. And Devon Miller does kids' books. And this one that he did that we're going to play at the bottom of the hour is really terrific. But right now, I get to turn to somebody. Wow, I'm so happy that he's here because I love this book. For so many reasons, and I hope he's prepared to spend the entire hour with me, because normally I do, you know, my segments are like 22 minutes, and today I would really like to talk and get deep into this book by Mark J. Strauss. It's called One-Legged Mongoose. It is it's a relevant book, it's an important book, and it's a beautifully written book. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you.
Wow. As I said, I was really thrilled when I got this book and I started reading it for many reasons. There are many things in this book that really touched my heart. And the subject, part of the subject is really difficult to deal with, the fact is this book is so beautifully written. It is so visual, it's so cinematic. I was enthralled with it right from page one. So let's start by talking about you were a reader as a young child, and that happened to me too. I was reading, for my audience all knows that my first book was actually, my first adult book was a Perry Mason paperback. I read it when I was 5 years old and told my mother's Pinnacle Club all about it. And, of course, they didn't believe that I could read. But I was reading at that level. And so we have this in common. Tell us about your reading experience.
My older sister, Miriam, really taught me to read. When I was 3 and 4 years old, she'd give me a nickel for every book I finished. And I think the first book that really made an impact was Tom Sawyer.
And how old were you then?
Five.
So, you know, it's funny. When you read at that age, you, in many ways, you just don't fit in. I mean, I was also in the same predicament. I go to kindergarten, and they are learning the alphabet, and I'm reading, you know, mystery thrillers. It makes a difference in how we look on life, and I think part of the thing is why your book is so beautifully written. You became an observer of people.
I think I say in this book, in One-Legged Mongoose, that when I was five, I showed up late to kindergarten, and I spent the year under the piano. I got there, and for the first 3 weeks, the teacher was teaching the letter A, and I guess I couldn't stand it after a while. So she just punished me. There was this little stool, and I literally sat under the piano that year.
Well, in those days, they didn't understand, they really didn't understand gifted children. So let's step back. This, you know, this entire story is set in the 1950s. Explain about the period and how you decided to write it from the child's point of view, a 10-year-old's point of view.
The book begins right after I've turned 10, and it finishes just after I've turned 12. And it's a book I've wanted to write for a while. It's written in the voice of the kid that I was then, and I realized that that's very rare, and I had advice from very notable writers that I should write it in the voice of the adult, of course, as many of them have done. And I couldn't do it because, one, I know too much now, and I'd be changing things, and I'd get in the way. And the second reason is I was just lucky to have this very complete memory. And for me, it was just the same as writing poetry. I would drop back in the space. I would be able to see everything, hear everything. And it felt like I just got out of the way of the kid and let the kid speak.
Well, it's so natural. And after, you know, just a paragraph, you're with this kid and you feel it. You feel the story. And as I said, it's very visual writing. One sees everything. And I just enjoyed it so much. So tell us, you know, when you, so this would have been what year? This is in the 50s.
1953.
Wow, there are a lot of changes going on in the world at that point. And tell us a little bit about the background of the, you know, the family and how this story came about.
We were a family that moved to Long Island when I was 3 years old. My dad had a textile store in the lower Manhattan. He was an immigrant who came to the U.S. when he was 15 and just started working full-time. And a few years later, he opened his own store. And it really is a story of that time because from my fifth birthday, I started working in the store virtually every Sunday and many summers, and I loved it. And I grew up with him in the business, and it was a different education. We see it in some immigrant groups today that kids might do this. But for me, I loved every minute of it. In fact, to scroll ahead, I worked there until I graduated medical school. My mother's parents came over here, and when my dad made a little money, he did what a lot of immigrants did. He bought a little house in Long Island, and my older sister, my younger brother, and I went to the local public school, which was atrocious. I mean, the education was just awful. But then, just as I turned 10, my dad announces that I'll be taking my kid brother, Stephen, to a school in Queens, and our commute was going to be 4 hours a day, and it was an ultra-religious Jewish yeshiva, and we weren't religious. and I knew my dad so well, and he never explained it, just we're going. And the book opens up when I'm with my mom on a hot, hot summer day in her car, and she's chain-smoking, and I'm going to my first Hebrew lesson. I have to take these lessons all summer to get accepted to a school I don't want to get accepted to. So that's the setting.
And, of course, you know, in those days, I say in those days, but I guess nothing has changed, although at one point I had thought everything would change. Your life was really difficult. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. So, you know, that plays a big part in your book.
It was really embedded in the town I was in Long Island, in West Hempstead, there were very, very few Jews then, and that's interestingly, it's changed. And I even understood as a little kid that the kids weren't born anti-Semitic or anti-anything. This is something they heard in their house. And it was really rampant. And the kids would find out we were Jewish. We had bright red hair, so not everybody figured it out for a while. And my kid brother, Stephen, was just a little kid, and he was a scared kid. And he was a magnet for bullies. And they found him. And I would always find out who had hurt him. And then I'd really exact retribution, and I just became a really good street fighter. And I even heard some of the parents say just horrendous anti-Semitic things, even to me. And you'll see later we encountered that. It sounds more subtle, but I encountered that on my Boy Scout weekend. So yeah, I mean, it was there. And, of course, now we see this again today much more visibly, unfortunately.
Well, for me, it was, I mean, one of the first things, one of my first memories, actually, is that I was chosen to play in the first grade. I was chosen to play Mary in the Christmas program. And one of the teachers, my teachers, chose me, one, because she thought I was just the right person to play it because I was bold and brave and wasn't afraid to get on stage in those days. Actually, it probably changed me because after that I became shy. But one of the other teachers said to her, well, you can't let her play Mary. And my teacher asked why, and she said, well, because she's Jewish. Like, you get it, lady. You didn't read the Bible. You don't understand. You don't understand. I wasn't supposed to be allowed to play. And because they had, you know, for the donkey, they had a hobby horse where I was going to sit on wheels so I could sit on it. And, I, you know, that's like the plum part. You know, you're Mary, for goodness sake. And so that other teacher who was, you know, it just sort of butted in to my teacher, and my teacher let me play Mary. But, you know, it was my first experience of something like that. Be told, she can't play Mary.
Well, in kindergarten, the same awful teacher, and really meant in a bad way, wanted me to stand up and explain to the class about Hanukkah because they were having Christmas. And I really didn't want to do it, and I didn't think it was any of their business. And I also had this notion that anything I said about Hanukkah would be misunderstood. I mean, everybody has their fables and their stories and their... And, she was nasty about it, and it was very intentional.
Well, as you said, an adult, I mean, why this teacher would say such a thing and say it in front of me so that I could hear her, you know, it boggled my mind. And for years, I mean, I just sort of clammed up because I really thought it was a terrible thing, you know, for an adult to do.
It was very overt and something that has improved in this country over the decades is it improved and kids began not to hear that and adults weren't so open. It's much more open again.
Yes, and this I don't understand. I had lived overseas for a number of years, for quite a few years, and I was surprised when I came back and, I don't know, discovered that that all of the racial problems were back, all of the religious problems. I just somehow I had avoided all of that overseas, and so it was rather startling. Now, in your book, of course, there's so much to your book. How much do you want to talk about one of the, you know, it's painful in some ways. Your story is, how you relate the story is so sometimes so funny, sometimes heartwarming, and very touching. But there's also a undercurrent of something pretty terrible.
Yeah, it was something. My kid brother Stephen talked to me. He and I remained so close in our adulthood, and he asked me not to write this book while my mom was alive. And it was very difficult for me not to agree when Stephen asked. So I did wait, and we were not such a different household than many immigrant or near immigrant families and middle class families. And my dad worked all the time, dropped us off in this town he knew nothing about, and just worked humongous hours. My mother was quite a brilliant woman, and the secret hidden in our house is that she physically abused me. And this began before I was 2 years old, and we see it in this book. And of course, I'm trying to find a way to extricate myself from it. But she would become explosive unexpectedly. And it was something my kid brother witnessed, my older sister, but nobody else knew.
And you protected Stephen. It's so beautiful, the parts that you write about Stephen. It's this love that you share, and that, you know, it's so wonderful that it's continued and that you still have each other. Sometimes I would get tears in my eyes as I was reading.
Well, sadly, maybe the worst call I ever got was years ago. He called me to tell me he had just gotten a scan.
Oh, no,
and
I didn't know.
Yeah, and he had a brain tumor and passed away when he was 60. He had, he was an extraordinarily brilliant scientist and worked at the National Institutes of Health his entire career, and was the chief of virology and then head of an institute.
Wow, I didn't realize that. I'm sorry. Well, yeah. He's in your heart, and that's wonderful. And he's in your book. And he shines through as a wonderful, wonderful child. And to go through that, I want people to read this book for so many reasons. One, because people have to start thinking about what they're saying, what they're doing, because part of it is this horrible anti-Semitism, but also this abuse that sometimes people won't talk about, and that, you know, mental health problems. I'm sure, I don't know whatever your mother was eventually diagnosed with, or if ever diagnosed with, but these problems have to be addressed, and you have to do it, you know, before a child is harmed, and you still are suffering from that.
I was, when the news came out about these Penn State athletes, I just guess I wasn't surprised that even boys who were college students had been abused, and for the most part, never told anyone. And it took a while to unravel this. When kids are abused, they just take it in, and it's damaging, and they rarely tell anybody. And then you see what happened to these women athletes and just how awfully long it took place in the cover-ups. And I think there is a real awareness now, but the abuse of kids that happened even with priests, look how long it took to unravel that story and the resistance. And the disbelief of some of the early kids who came forward. So it's an international story, and for the first time in the last couple of decades, it's out in the open. But when it happens in the quiet of one's home, you never hear about it.
I know. It's, it just, when I, there's one particular chapter that, you know, when I read it, it just broke my heart. And of course, it's near the end of the book, and it's called Pool Stick. And that chapter is so beautifully written. You are such a fine author. You know, so although we have, I mean, I don't want people to get the idea that it's just, you know, about the heaviness or the hard parts of your life. But there's also so many fascinating things that you've done, so many fascinating things that, you know, as a child, how your mind was working, how you observed things, how you thought about things, and I want to talk in a little while, I want to talk about the period of that period of time. I'd like to hear what you remember about the polio scares and about other things that were happening in the 50s that you can relate to people and also relate to what's been happening now that we're going through a pandemic, because you can look back on that. So I'm going to play, as I said, I'm playing a promo, and this is one of the things that I do here on Joy and Paper. You know, people write books, and then they get a moment in time, a few weeks, maybe a month, 2 months to promote their books, and then you never get an opportunity again. People don't do interviews with you. People don't call you up. People don't mention your name on the radio. People don't. So what we do here is we do these, what we call book buzzes. They're 1 minute or 2 minute promos, and they tell about a book that I don't want people to forget. Now, this promo is one that I found this wonderful young man who himself, he had been in the hospital a great deal of time when he was a child. He loved reading. He started writing. And so he's just so passionate about getting children to read. And he's done this book promo. And because it is Black History Month, I want to play it. I'd like you to listen to it. And then there's going to be a few commercials, but don't hang up, because I want to come back to you and I want to talk about the 1950s and get more details about your memories of that period. Okay?
Sure.
Okay, so listen to this promo and then we'll be back after a few commercials.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Already ranking in as the number one new release on Amazon for children's African history fiction within its first month of release is the book Black Boy Fly, written by bestselling author Amanda Lynch. In Amanda's sixth published book, readers get to fly across the pages with Amanda's character, MJ. This book encourages young boys to be unapologetic about their identity, history, and giftedness. The book also features gorgeous and eye-popping illustrations done by Bonnie LeMaire. As a bonus, the book includes 100 affirmations young boys can repeat with their parents and teachers to reinforce self-esteem and confidence. Amanda wrote the book as not only being a love letter to her son Amani, but to many other Black and brown boys around the world. She also wanted to be a part of the change to diversify children's book literature, which is really, really cool. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's book buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727 353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Mark J. Strauss, and the name of his book is One-Legged Mongoose, Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
It's great to have you on the program today, because I think this book is so, it's really a very, very special book. And there are just so many aspects to it. So let's talk about a few of the things that you've written about. Let's talk about Twinkie for a moment, because I thought that was a great story.
Yeah, I just want to pronounce the title of the book, if I may, because it's a little bit odd. It's One-Legged Mongoose.
Oh, I'm one-legged. You're right.
No. Yeah, and it's interesting, because after the book came out, a friend said, well, you know, you're lucky. If you Google one-legged mongoose, there's never been a title like that ever, so they're going to get your book. So that's good.
That's for sure. There isn't.
Twinkie was my white-haired terrier. And when I was younger than this, I had my grandmother bought me a dog, but it wasn't house-trained, so naturally my mother got rid of it. And I thought, well, how can you get a new dog that's house trained? But Twinkie came to us when she was two, and this dog, even my mother said, was a genius dog. But the dog quickly latched on to me and spent all its time with me. And I never owned a leash, and I was always off wherever I wanted. I mean, my parents never questioned what I did once I went out the door. So I was off on my bike, and I'd sometimes go several towns away. One of the towns had a great library, and Twinkie would come with me, and then I'd park her outside and just say, wait until I come out, and that dog wouldn't move. And when I went to school, she would out most of the day and come back when she was ready. And I felt in Twinkie that she needed the kind of freedom we all needed. And I would never have, you know, chained her or put her in her house. And this was a dog that was partly a savior to me, because we had that kind of boy-dog relationship that's so unusual and so precious.
It is precious. The funny thing is, I had the same type of dog. His name was Sammy, and he also was never on a leash, and he would follow me. I was the first girl to have a paper route in my little town. And that, you know, he would be chasing after me when I was on my bike delivering papers, and exactly that same wonderful, just wonderful love that he. I never had a dog after that, because there was never a dog like him.
It was tough. There was only one Twinkie, and that dog was smart. I once teased the dog, and I would stand in front of the house, and I wouldn't even turn in the direction. I'd say, Twinkie, there's a rat in that sewer. And that dog would run to the corner sewer and bark down the sewer. It was incredible.
That relationship is really something special. Tell us about, I want to go sort of pop around and your memories of those years, because one of the things you mentioned, of course, is polio. And so many, I mean, young people don't know about it. If they've heard about it recently, you know, when we've been talking about the pandemic, that's probably the first time they've ever heard about it. Now, I came after once they had the vaccination. But tell us your memories of polio from those days and the fear that people had.
Well, polio was the big fear. And so many families would go to the country in the summer. And a lot of the families that we knew would go to the Catskills and they'd go to a bungalow colony. The idea was get away from polio, which was rampant in the summer. And polio was a virus. It was a disease that caused paralysis and even death. And when I was even much younger than this book, I saw a girl down the street, and she was brought out on a stretcher in an iron lung. And it was one of these unbelievable, almost horrible sci-fi contraptions. And kids died, and it was a disease primarily of kids. And some of the people who survived had paralysis or paralysis of a leg. The President Franklin Roosevelt had paralysis from polio, and he hid it from the public. So he would go around in a wheelchair and campaign, and it was extraordinary how well they hid the fact that he was paralyzed. So that was the big fear. And when it was one summer, and it was later in the book, and I was 11, and I was upstairs where the bedrooms were, and I went to walk downstairs, and my feet wouldn't hold me. And then it was a question of a couple of days and going to a neurologist and having the diagnosis made that I had polio. But there was no treatment. And this was just shortly before the vaccine came out, the Salk vaccine. But what probably isn't remembered at all, there was a precursor to the final vaccine, and there were a couple hundred deaths, so it was withdrawn. And I'll come back to COVID in a minute, because I think you're getting at it, and it's just so relevant. And so when I was diagnosed and there was no treatment, they gave me this horrible IV shot that they weren't sure would do good or harm. And then the only thing I could do was bed rest and wait and see what happens. So I spent the summer in bed, and eventually I began to recover, and I had full recovery by the end. We found out after that period of time, people didn't know it then, that approximately two-thirds of the people who get polio are asymptomatic. And, of course, that's pretty relevant again today. When the vaccine came out again, every single person got it. There was no hesitation. There were some side effects in some people. But there wasn't a doubt by families that you didn't want to get polio, so you took the vaccine. And the number of cases were so few in comparison today, and the number of deaths were minuscule compared to COVID. But that was the scourge, and that was what everybody worried about. And I think we haven't seen anything quite like that until COVID. So my personal opinion, and of course you know I'm also a physician, is that this vaccination is so safe. And And any data that the vaccination may be harmful isn't being hidden. There have been tens of millions of people vaccinated, and it's probably the most side effect free such thing we've ever had. And if we had deaths from it, people would know it. I mean, you can't really hide it. And yet here we are today, and so many people refuse to get vaccinated. And back then, when you had polio and the vaccine was not so safe, everybody took it. We're really at a very different time.
It certainly is. Now, was that why you got into medicine? Was this and also your brother into virology?
I don't know. I don't know why, except, I mean, I say in the book that I know, even though my father didn't say so out loud, what did he want his two boys to do? I mean, he was an impoverished immigrant when he came to New York. I mean, just had gone through terrible starvation and poverty. He came here, and to him, the person you most looked up to was a doctor. So his goal was he wanted his kids well-educated and wanted his boys to be doctors. And I was sure I would not do it, so much for my being sure. But, yeah, Stephen and I both became physicians. And I think that polio probably played a role for me, at least in how I thought about patient care. So there are a couple chapters in this book when, you know, first when I go to this neurologist and I want to know what's going on, and he answers me. You know, he's rare. He's not just talking to my mother as if I'm not in a room. You know, I may be an 11-year-old, but I've got a lot of questions, and he's being very direct in answering me. Later in the book, we see that I was hospitalized again. I was in a bad hit and run. I was hit really badly by a car, and I'm hospitalized. I'm hurt really badly, and they put me first. Of course, I'm in the ER, and then I'm moved up to this ward. And they stuck tubes everywhere, but no one would answer my questions. And they would have rounds. You know, the doctors would come in the morning, and his trainees would be with him. And I would ask a question, and they wouldn't answer me. I mean, you don't tell kids. You don't answer them. Or in some cases, in the worst cases, and I've seen this happen in medicine, you know, the doctors come in and they stand around the patients and they talk to them as if it's somebody else. And it had an enormous impact in my thinking once I became a doctor, the importance of good patient communication. So I think all those things were part of the reason. I just didn't know it then.
Well, you know, there are so many things in this book. One of the things that you talk about, and of course, the relationship with black people in the community too, because you have this story. Tell us what was it like then, and what is it? What's happening today?
Well, we had no black kids in our public school. None in our town. And my God, I don't think they would have survived in that town. And then I'm suddenly moved to a school in Queens, New York, so of course it's different. And but then I go to a private Jewish school and there are no black kids. And Hempstead, that whole area back then, and I talk about it very little. There was what they called the Black Ward. And it was pretty well known that, you know, white kids did not go in that neighborhood, and black kids pretty much didn't come out of that neighborhood. The segregation was almost absolute. I wound up later going to college in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and there was a black ward, and it was the same. So there was a chapter in this book called Sugar Ray.
Yeah, that's the chapter I was thinking about, yeah.
Yeah. And I've had, like, no contact with black kids ever. You know, you only knew about it. You only knew about stories. But I was really knowledgeable about baseball. So, to me, Jackie Robinson of the Brooklyn Dodgers was a great player. And Willie Mays was maybe the greatest of the New York Giants. And I understood the racism that had been involved in not allowing blacks to play professional baseball. Like Elston Howard, I mentioned the book, was the first black who played in the Yankees. And the Yankees were lily white. You know, they took years to be willing to hire a black player. So in Sugar Ray, I wind up in this yeshiva, and my grade is in an annex 2.5 miles away. So I drop off my brother, and then sometimes over noon, I have to go back. I'm at the main school, and then I got to go in the afternoon to this annex, and I often walk. So we were right off Jamaica Avenue, and I got bored once, and I thought, I'm going to walk a different way. So I go on a parallel street, Atlantic Avenue, and I'm walking along the street, and the neighborhood was suddenly totally different. You know, broken awnings, stores out of business, drunks leaning against the front doors. And as I'm partway down the block, I see four black kids, a couple years older than me, and they're kind of congregating together, and I realize, uh-oh, I'm on the wrong street. You know, all my fist fights, I'd never encountered a black kid. So I'm not so far from them, and I figured, well, no sense running. Everybody knows black kids run faster anyway, like Jesse Owens. So I'm getting close to them, and they start razzing me and calling me white bread and telling me they're going to beat me up. And I just walk right over to them, and the tallest kid is always the leader. He steps forward, and he starts razzing me and said, you know, we're just going to beat your ass up. And I said, well, what are you going to accomplish? You know, four kids going to beat up one little white kid, and what are you going to get out of that? Why don't you fight me one-on-one? And they weren't expecting that. And he said, you know, you're not afraid for a white kid, are you? I said, no, I'm not afraid of you. And then we start getting into a conversation, and one kid they call Sugar Ray. So I said, you mean like Sugar Ray Robinson? He says, yeah. And I said, well, he's the greatest boxer of all time. And the kid said, yeah, of course. And we get into a little conversation about Sugar Ray Robinson. And then one kid's holding this handball. And I say, you know, you play handball? I was really a good handball player. And the tall kid says, yeah, why don't you play me for money? And I said, I don't have any money with me, but I'll play, and I'm going to beat you. And he said, we're going to see about that. We're going to see about that. And the chapter ends when we're turning the corner, and we're all going to the park to play handball.
That's why I wanted to mention that one, because, I mean, this is what I get so frustrated. It doesn't have to be the way it is. That's why I wish people, and really I hope that they will read your book and start thinking about their actions and about how, you know, this is from the 1950s. This is we're now in 2022, if you can believe it. But there are so many lessons to be learned in One-Legged Mongoose. written by Mark J. Strauss. It's a great book, beautifully written. And I think it opens people's eyes to both the discrimination, abuse. And it's also just simply a great read, because you have written wonderfully well about, particularly, I think, about, you know, Stephen and Miriam, and it's a great book.
Well, these black kids down the end of the street, this was their hangout. They never had any white kids in their life, and back then there was total segregation, and that was before the Civil Rights Law in 64, and blacks sat in the back of the bus, and I had never spoken to a black kid, and that wasn't so unusual. But, you know, we found common ground so quickly. Sugar Ray Robinson, you know, sports. Later in the book, we learn that I'm going to this yeshiva, but I'm cutting so many classes, and I still can't figure out why nobody knew about it. Like, how could they know I was gone half the time? So for a while, when I was cutting classes, I'd be out in the city parks, and this tall kid, he and I were doubles partners, and we were unbeatable. And I remark how funny it is when the two of us show up at a park, and everybody sees this little white kid and this big, tall black kid, and they think, well, they're going to win, but they never do.
Well, I think the way that you relate all these stories, it's very touching. It's a wonderful book. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
Oh, sure. Mark J. Strauss. It's M-A-R-C J. Strauss, STRAUS.com. Thank you.
And the book, of course, is available online, and hopefully bookstores are open again. Looks like things are starting to open up again. And I hope that they'll have that, you know, there. And are you doing appearances? Do you have events that you're attending?
I have. I was just down in Florida this past weekend doing a book reading at a library in West Palm Beach. And the next event I have is I'm invited to Franklin Marshall College in 2 weeks for a book event and a reading. And they're beginning to start again. I mean, these in-person ones were just non-existent, as you know.
Yeah, well, it's good that you can get out there, start talking to people, meeting people, and really telling them how, you know, if you look at things from the 1950s and then you realize it's so many years later, that there are things that need to be, we should have changed a long time ago. And it's not too late. We can all learn, and people can definitely learn from your book, because it's really great. Probably you'll get a movie deal one day with this book, huh?
Well, I'm getting wonderful things. People are writing to me, and one of the things they're writing the most is, you got to get a movie. Who's going to play the kid? Who's going to play the kid?
Some lucky kid, some kid actor is going to come out with, it's going to be terrific. It is, as I said from the beginning when I started, I said it's cinematic. I saw it in my head, and I think somebody will option it, because it's a book that will, it'll make a great film. Absolutely.
Oh, boy, I'd like that, I hope.
Okay, well, we'll continue to promote it here on Joy on Paper. We'll get it out there and also on our social media, so that we can get people interested to read the book. And then when you get a movie deal, will you come back and tell us about it?
You'll be first. Thank you.
Okay, make it breaking news. I don't get a lot of breaking news, so it would be lots of fun to have you back on here as soon as somebody options it. And I think somebody out there in Hollywood is going to get it.
you know, I think you're out in Palm Springs. You're out in Palm Springs. There's lots of movie people there.
No, I'm based in New York City.
In New York City, normally. Well, and of course, you have a gallery there, right?
I own an art gallery under my name, Mark Strauss, and I'm on the Lower East Side, across the street from where I worked for my dad in a store. And for me, working on Grand Street in New York was a homecoming. I love it.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's wonderful. And, of course, maybe, I don't know, I'll be traveling again, you know. But I love to come to New York, and if I come, I'll come and see you, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, so I look forward to hearing from you and about somebody who options this wonderful book, because it's going to be a great film. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's One Legged Mongoose. It is The Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York. It's just filled with so many interesting things, and you have some photos there, which I found very enjoyable. Anyway, thank you again, Mark, for being
thank
on
you.
Joy on Paper.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Wow. This is his first book. It's a memoir, but I tell you, it reads like a novel. I had to sort of like pinch myself every once in a while and realize it's not a novel. It really happened. So the parts, the abuse that happened in his life, it's real. And you can see, I mean, this is a long time ago, and it's still there in his heart and in his soul. And I hope that people, if you know anybody who is being abused or you think that there's abuse in a family, you know, open up a conversation, because that's one of the things that I did as part of my women's group. We sort of helped intervene in some situations. So there are ways to go about it, ways to help people, because you don't want a child to be abused and 70 years later they're still suffering from it. It's not right. That's why, you know, this book, although it has this as an underlying, you know, current, the actual story about New York at the time, about life and just running around New York and all of the things he did, fantastic. Oh, I am running out of time. Big Ed is playing my music, because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. And both of her series, oh my goodness, she's got a new book coming out, book 12 in her Witch City Mysteries, and it's called Till Death, and you can pre-order it now. It's available online. Go and pre-order it. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed. Thank you so much, Ed. I got 28 seconds to say, and he saluted me. I saluted him. Everybody, have an absolutely wonderful weekend, and we're having a glorious time here in Florida. Bye-bye now.